So we have started getting together in person for things, both in our society in general and in our life as a community at the table. And the steps sometimes feel a bit awkward. I was thinking about this. I was like, it's kind of like showing up at a dance thinking we knew how to do that thing, and then finding out there's this new dance now that we don't know, and that really nobody knows, and that we're all making it up together again. And that dance, that social dance in particular that I'm thinking of, it often starts with how we greet one another. Does this need to happen from 6 feet away? Once we're indoors, are we in a situation where it's masks on or masks off? The new Mr. Miyagi, mask on, mask off. Anyway, or is there some of each about the masks, depending on mutual comfort? Or is this on until we're eating and drinking, and then off when we're eating and drinking, and then back on, or and so on and so forth, right? And when some of us showed up at Justin's place for our Sunday gathering last week, Amy and Steve were there, along with their kids, Jordan and Jenna. And I haven't seen them in person for, I actually tried to think of when the last time was when I was writing this, and I couldn't. I don't know how long, really long. And I miss them, and I miss seeing their faces, and I miss hearing their voices, and I miss being in the same space with them. And I could tell that that's part of the story about many people in the community, of course, but I want to be specific before I generalize. And also, I asked them if I could share this story with all of you, and they said they were fine with that. So when I greeted Amy at Justin's, there was this mutual, do we give one another a hug? Because we were both feeling like that'd be lovely. And so there was this moment, which for my part, I think we navigated pretty well. We just sort of had the conversation. Are we hugging? And we agreed that we were, and then we did. And that was lovely. And Jenna, who was standing beside her mom and who has gotten magically taller over the intervening months and years, and suddenly struck me as, the pending young adult that she truly is. Jenna was looking a lot like I was feeling, kind of like, how do we do this social thing again? And so I just asked her. I said, Jenna, can I ask you a personal question? And she said I could. So I just jumped right in, and I sort of sat down beside her, and I said, Jenna, does this feel weird? And she just nodded, and she shared this little very Jenna smile with me, and she summed it up. She said, yes. And then she proceeded to jump right in with Amy and help out with the littles, which is so lovely. Greeting one another when we're not sure what the social norms are can be pretty complicated sometimes. And I feel like in some ways, and I don't want to misuse the term, which I know has had some particular applications for us in terms of relational interchanges, but I feel like we find ourselves in a culture of consent at a whole new level, where we're negotiating our shared physical spaces and exchanges in much more overt and detailed and even sort of formalized ways than we might have been accustomed to, especially if we mostly spent our, before times in cultural settings where the people we were with had similar backgrounds and values and status and social norms, and we were familiar to one another. And all of a sudden, it feels like there's a level at which we're unfamiliar to one another. And that moment at the door when we enter a new space and we are aware that we don't necessarily know or feel confident what the norms are, but we know that we want to respect those norms and that the people whose space we're entering, we feel confident about that. That's something that it feels like we're learning or perhaps relearning how to do. And it might feel kind of new and unfamiliar to us, but like many things having to do with pandemics, as it turns out, it might feel kind of new and unfamiliar to us, but it has ancient and deep roots right here in this part, geographically speaking, in this part of the world. You know that land acknowledgement practice that we usually share when we gather, the one I said I was going to do something different with? It can feel like that's kind of a token apology, for something we maybe didn't directly do. Maybe it can feel like sort of a blanket, I'm sorry too, for the massive destructive impact of the colonial project. And hey, we're Canadian, so we're pretty good at saying we're sorry, right? Even if it sometimes feels like we're doing it as a smokescreen for continuing to perpetuate or to participate in oppressive systems. But here's a thing about that land acknowledgement practice that we might not be aware of, and it's the kind of thing that I think can utterly alter what we think we're doing when we take the time to pause to do it. Acknowledging whose homeland we're on is a long-standing indigenous practice. And I want to focus on that because it can feel like it's a relatively new, predominantly white person or settler heritage or colonial heritage practice, right? And in terms of its emergence as a common social opener, that may be true. But to stop there is to ignore the richness of its history and the wide application of that awareness. When we list off the specific names of tribes as part of, in this part of the world, of a Treaty 1 acknowledgement, we are gesturing towards something that has been going on here for thousands of years. This piece of the continent, the piece that in that practice we define as Treaty 1 territory, this piece of the continent was shared and is still shared by several different indigenous peoples. These days, when we do that land acknowledgement, we typically name the Anishinaabe, the Cree, the Oji-Cree, the Dakota, and the Dene peoples, as well as the Métis Nation. As my indigenous kin have been teaching me, when you come as an indigenous person to visit someone from another tribe at their home, you acknowledge that and you ask what their traditions are and what their practices are. As one of the first indigenous teachers to come and visit and share with our community told us, which way you pass the pipe around the circle isn't a given. You find out how it works in the homeland of the tribe that you're with, and you do it that way. When we showed up at Justin and Kirby's place last week, the closet door by the entry was open, there were hangers in it, and there were mats by the door for our shoes. Chairs were distanced in the shared gathering space. People had their masks on. We could all pay attention and take our cues from our hosts. That's how things work here. And if we weren't sure about a detail or a particular practice, we could have the conversation and figure out together what mutual respect and dignity looked like under the circumstances. And then we could proceed from there. Land acknowledgement is that moment when we come in the door of someone else's place, we acknowledge that we're guests, and we deliberately open ourselves to learning how things work in this space so we can honor our hosts and be kind and gracious guests. And when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission included land acknowledgement in their calls to action, they weren't trying to make people grovel. They were reminding us all that when you're a guest, it's just common courtesy to consider how things work in the space you're visiting and to act accordingly. When someone from that space chooses to come and visit you in your space, they can do the same. We could bundle that all up and call it a shared land. We might choose to call it a shared Canada. We might not. We might use other language for that. I would say that no matter how we talk about it politically and geographically, in the end, it's called kindness, kindness. Behaving like we're all connected and like this place where we live is also connected to and shared by all. And that could truly be considered another expression of the sorts of values that are typical of the stage of doubt and faith we've been exploring these past few weeks. It could truly be considered as an expression of the interconnectedness of everything and everyone. One of the first courses that I took that dealt directly with the intersection between my sort of nurtured or historic Christian understandings of the world and many themes in indigenous worldviews didn't happen until I was doing graduate studies. I think that's kind of crazy, hey? That I could get an entire undergrad degree in the heart of this continent, including several courses that were about worldviews and belief systems, and never, in the course of that entire degree, never encounter indigenous worldviews once. Not at all. Looking back on it now, I would describe that silence as either deafening or, at best, the product of very selective hearing. But in this particular course, this prof, who was subsequently arrested and sentenced to house arrest for quite a while for chaining himself to a bulldozer in protest of old growth logging on unceded lands, an exercise in civil disobedience that, you know, turned out to be beyond the pale of what was acceptable as free speech. I think it had to do with the material act of chaining himself to the bulldozer. In any case, that prof in that course talked about being at a world religions conference and meeting a Cree shaman and realizing in conversation with that person that he had more in common with their worldview than with any of the Christian theologians or practitioners at this event. And I would say that one of the reasons that might have been their experience, just reflecting on it as a former student at this point, was that this prof took the poetics of the Hebrew creation stories as we find them in Genesis collections deeply to heart, and particularly the parts of those narratives that remind us that we all come from the earth, that we all come from the dirt. And that notion that the earth is the mother we have in common, that the stuff of earth is the birther and nurturer of us all and the source of wisdom, is, dare I say it, stirred right in to our shared understandings of what it means to be human. Perhaps we could say that we might not be so clear on our father imagery, but we've got our mother in common. And I would say also, not surprisingly, the Hebrew poets knew it. And I feel confident about that, because why else would the very oceans and the forests and the skies that they could observe, why else would they be described as having voices? Why else would they be described as having breath, of being fully able to speak to and speak of Creator with such force and such beauty and such majesty that they would be bundled together with humanity in those poets' work as everything that lives? It's hardly a shock that this isn't the part of the Hebrew narrative that has been emphasized by Christians within the context of the colonial project. And I would say that isn't a shock, because to emphasize that, those deep mythical roots of the understanding that everything is connected, to emphasize that would have been essentially incompatible with using religious beliefs to justify the oppression of other humans and to justify the heedless extraction of resources, both of which can easily run roughshod over our shared origins and our fundamental connection to the earth. And I said easily run roughshod. I'm going to say they can't run without running roughshod over those things. If we leave out this part of the story, we are leaving out the part that might correct our actions. I read an article the other day which quoted a American megachurch pastor who was wondering if they could continue to hold that kind of a role under the conditions in their community, the political conditions, among other things, in their community. Quoted them as saying often to their community, if your sacred text doesn't correct your politics once in a while — this is a bit of a paraphrase — but if it doesn't adjust your politics once in a while, you're probably just not paying attention to what the text is saying. And this is one of those things. If the whole orb of the library that Christianity said is their sacred texts had been carried forward as values in the colonial project, we would not have had residential schools. It would have been impossibly incompatible with the values carried in those texts. I know that's strong. Feel free to disagree. Just don't do it in the comments section right now, because I'll be super distracted. Do it in person later. We don't treat people with whom we share parentage and whose place we respectfully share in those ways. We do not abuse them. We do not strip them of things that are essential to the full expression of humanity. We just don't do that. Any analogy that I make at this point is going to be far too weak. But with that caveat, let me suggest that to behave that way would be like thanking Justin for opening his front door and letting us in, and then proceeding to pile his furniture in a heap and setting it on fire because we wanted to get a better look at the flooring. This is not the way we treat one another. Not if we believe that we have our humanity, our source of life and sustenance, our parentage and our home in common. We don't do that. I believe that imagination is the engine of belief. It's what gives belief its power, its energy, its force. And I would say that if we fail in the collective project of reconciliation, if we fail in the collective project of making a just or more just society, it might be reasonable to describe it, at many points at least, as a failure of imagination. Writing in a 2017 article in The New Yorker, Canadian novelist and columnist Stephen Marsh put it this way. He wrote, "I wonder if English Canada has the strength to face the truth in the 2015 Truth and Reconciliation Commission report that the evil inflicted on the Indigenous populations of this country was not done by our worst people, but by our best. The colonists believed that hope for the Indigenous population meant stripping them of their language and culture and imbuing them with a spirit of thrift. They were trying to prepare them for the future, for progress." Now listen, this is the key. "And the only future and the only progress that they could imagine was the one presented to them as an inevitable fact by Britain and America. The only future and the only progress that they could imagine was the one presented to them as an inevitable fact by Britain and America." This is why continuing to evolve what we believe is a big deal, because if we don't, we can stay stuck in systems of belief that produce profoundly distorted understandings of the value of anyone not like us, and that make it possible for us to believe that our preferred version of culture actually represents the sort of last word about a good life that should, even must, be visited on others at whatever cost. Do we really need a bigger illustration of the way that that is not true than the one that we are living with? I hope not. In stage four, key values are things like being compassionate and seeking common good. Core assumptions in that stage include the notion that we're all connected, that we're all part of a greater whole. Our central take in stage four on that us-them dynamic is that we are all part of a bigger us, that there is no we apart from an us. In that sort of a structure, that sort of a matrix or belief, how might we think about leadership or authority, which are also key metrics in each of these stages? How might we think about those things within a stage four matrix? Well, as a starting point, in stage four, we acknowledge that leaders have the same characteristics that we all do, that they are, among other important things, fallible. That said, with a value like common good as a guide, we will expect those we trust with leadership to have the best interests of others clearly at the heart of the how, what, and why of their decisions, as opposed to self-interest or aggrandizement or just sticking at the job long enough to grab the golden parachute on the way out the side door, leaving the mess for the next person or group or generation. We expect better than that. We don't expect infallibility, but we expect better than that. And we will seek to both understand and practice the substance of an idea that is succinctly articulated by, of all people, Adam Smith, in the opening sentences of his Theory of Moral Sentiments. And I would say of all people about Smith, because Smith is commonly regarded as the first theorist of market economics, market economics being an economic system in which production and prices are determined by, you know, unrestricted competition between privately owned businesses. That's the core of those ideas came from Smith in the Western world. And some of Smith's ideas, including notions like the trickle down of wealth, because that's how he sort of solved the problem of if we have this market economy, how do we, you know, what happens to the people who aren't able to or don't choose to participate in that sort of competitive realm? The way he resolved that question was by saying, well, the wealth will trickle down. And that has demonstrably not worked well when it comes to serving the common good. So like I said, fallible, like us, and still worth considering. So with a note to consciously widen the patriarchal language that Smith uses, here's the idea that I was referencing. So Smith writes in the opening sentences of not his book about market economics, but his theory of moral sentiments. He writes this: how selfish soever man may be supposed, there are evidently some principles in his nature which interest him in the fortunes of others and render their happiness necessary to him, though he derives nothing from it except the pleasure of seeing it. In other words, Smith is saying, though we are clearly acquisitive, that's not all we are. We are also concerned with one another and with doing what is right by one another, with imagining and working for a future that is informed by the good of the whole, not just select groups within the whole. Perhaps Smith's ideas justifying the accumulation of wealth and its trickle-down effects fail to materialize more than they do because they are underpinned, at least in part, by the profound misunderstanding that some people, in his case men, but it could just as well be people of another ethnicity or culture or creed or socioeconomic strata, that some people are more suited to wealth and power than others, or his assumption that infinite market growth is necessary and inevitable. Maybe those ideas about caring for one another fail when they fail because we can't imagine how the common good might need to be strongly communal value, not just a quirky personal preference, if we're going to form cultures in which all people have value and are accorded dignity, and in which all people are free and not oppressed, and in which freedom is enjoyed with the understanding that self-limiting is an essential aspect of a good shared life, and so on. I would like to think, I may be deluded, I would like to think that, generally speaking, the talky bits in our context feel, first of all, invitational, and most of all, catalytic, and least of all, preachy. That said, I have a different Adam that I've quoted before in mind, Adam Grant. Speak as though you were convinced you're right. Listen as though you are, you know, sure you're wrong. Bit of a paraphrase, but that idea set, I want to try to live my life in that space. And I know that this morning I have spoken with some directness about things that I carry as convictions at this point in my own journey and process. I hope that everyone that listens and is a part of this can receive those as exactly that, as passionate point in the process for me. I expect my ideas to evolve and change. I hope they will. I hope that as long as I'm able, that will never stop. And I hope to be a part of that sort of process in relationships and friendships and communities as long as I'm able, which I hope will be a good long time yet. Well, that's a talky bit with a fair bit of idea density and maybe emotional density in it. That happens sometimes. Let me leave us with this. This is from an American novelist, poet, essayist, environmental activist, cultural critic, farmer, some would say contemporary prophet, a guy named Wendell Berry. Berry writes this: nature, which we've been speaking of nature as Earth primarily today. Nature is party to all our deals and decisions, and she has more votes, a longer memory, and a sterner sense of justice than we do. And I would add, I'm sure Barry says it elsewhere another way, but in this context, I would also add, she has the last word. And in many ways, she is reality. What will be here, whether we believe it or not. That's important. That's important when it comes to trying to imagine what a good world looks like under the sorts of ideas that frame stage four belief. Let me say it one other way. Mother knows best. And when it comes to the common good, we could do worse than to all pay attention to that reality when we're trying to figure out how we should behave as siblings. I'm going to leave it there. Peace to you all, and thanks for listening.